Is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, December 21st. We are here on a single oral argument. We're doing this via Zoom. We are making an audio recording only, which will be posted later on our website. So the case this morning is A20-0911, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce this, but Kjell Bjorn Peterson, petitioner respondent versus Rosalind Jean Kendrick, appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. I ask at the start of each of your principal arguments that you identify yourself and the party you represent for the record. And counsel for appellant, if you are ready to go, we are ready for you.
May it please the court. My name is Kristen Bullock on behalf of Rosalind Kendrick, the appellant in this matter. I want to let your honors know that this case has been pending before the Court of Appeals since 2020. I was involved in a near fatal accident in Mexico, which delayed this matter significantly to excessive traumatic injuries. I've had to rely on the kindness and patience of my family, my clients in this court here today. For me, this is a very big day and proof to me that I am a survivor, and proof that sometimes justice can move slowly, but nevertheless, it moves. I've had to not only learn, but teach my clients this very important lesson that justice is patient. It will come, you just have to wait, and here we are. I thank you all here today for everyone's patience, including opposing counsel.
Well, thank you. Let me just say we're very happy to see you, Ms. Bullock.
Thank you. We are here today because a district court abused its discretion on four main issues. The court erred and abused its discretion in determining endangerment and ordering a change in custody. The court abused its discretion in failing to appoint a guardian ad litem as required by Minnesota Statute 518.165. The court abused its discretion by not permitting the minor child to be interviewed and not considering the child's preference about parenting time. Finally, the court abused its discretion by excluding father's psychological evaluation, Exhibit 109A, and also not permitting the court-appointed psychologist to testify. On this basis, we are requesting that the Court of Appeals vacate the July 18th, 2019 order and the May 4th, 2020 custody order, and that the matter be remanded to address the motions regarding parenting time and taking the child's preference through interview and appointment of a guardian ad litem.
Ms. Bullock, can I ask you a specific question about, it seems to be overarching on these other issues. Your brief focuses on what you describe as the district court's prompting this case from a parenting time dispute to a custody dispute, and you say the district court abuses discretion, but you didn't cite any language in any rule or statute that would help inform me what you believe is the basis for the argument that the district court acted outside of its discretion in so treating the father's motion. Can you identify the statute or rule and tell us the language that you believe the court violated?
There is a statute that is, I'll have to look it up, but it's in my brief, and it requires for changes in custody to not only file an affidavit, but also to file moving papers, which that has still not before the court. There's been no motion filed, just merely an affidavit. The statute that provides for that is...
Well, I was focusing on, and I appreciate you have cited that in your brief. You were, as I understood the argument, concerned that the district court had moved this from a parenting time issue into a custody issue, and I just wanted to get a sense of the basis for that to constitute an abuse of the court's discretion? What is the statute or rule that you think limits the court in having the parties address custody?
I think just, my client had no notice that the court was going to unilaterally suggest or tell the opposing party to file a motion for custody, which they didn't do, or file supplemental affidavit for that.
Right, but by the time of the trial, there was plenty of opportunity for briefing and testimony and witnesses. I'm trying to get a sense of the fork in the road that you've pointed to, where this moved from a parenting time issue to a custody issue. I'm trying to get a sense of why that is an abuse of the court's discretion. The court was aware, had its own concerns based upon all of the presentation by the parties. And so I'm trying to get a sense of just overarching why that's an abuse of discretion. And if you want to move on to the other issues, that's fine. If you can't cite any rule or statute, if there is none, that's, I understand.
I'll just reiterate, and if I'm repeating myself, Your Honor can cut me off here, but there was no motion before the court, and it is illogical, in my opinion, that the court can just substitute its own preferences for custody and parenting time, which weren't the preferences of any of the litigants. The litigants, Mr. Peterson, indicated he wanted an equal parenting time schedule, and that he further stated, in, I believe, in his affidavit or on the court record at the hearing, that essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but it would be tantamount to endangerment if the court didn't order a equal parenting time schedule. Furthermore, he did state that that he did not want to go forth with. He didn't think it was appropriate to ask for custody, and that he thought it would be, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially endangerment to limit the mother's time beyond a 50-50% schedule. So I find it interesting that a judge believes that they can substitute two parents' opinions about what custody and parenting time should be. And just, there is a repetition of this particular court substituting.
Well, I mean, presumably the court can always act in the best interest of the child. I mean, I guess that's kind of where I would come out on that issue. And then, in looking at the rules of civil procedure, which respondent cites, under Rule 702, an application to the court for an order should be made by motion, which, unless made during a hearing or trial, so presumably, at the invitation of the court, the oral motion was made. I was wondering if you could switch, Ms. Bullock, to the guardian ad litem issue and chat about that with us for a while.
And what I would say to Your Honor real quick before I segue into the guardian ad litem issue, which is kind of dovetails into this issue, is that the statute in the domestic relations statute, I think it's 518.165, but I'm not sure I can find that exact statute if Your Honor wants me to, but that's what would apply here. And it says the court, if a party is seeking modification, they have to file an affidavit and moving papers. So I understand Your Honor's position that while there's a civil rule that says they can make an oral motion, not in family court for this type of issue. Now, dovetailing into the guardian ad litem issue, to me, that is the court's, I want to be respectful, but it seems a bit illogical to me that there was sufficient allegations and argument that to warrant a modification of custody in this fashion, but not sufficient to require the mandatory appointment of a guardian ad litem. To me, that is just merely inconsistent. And again, the court is sort of illogical in its approach under, on one hand, finding that, well, this is so significant, I have to unilaterally take away custody from mom, even though dad indicated in his pleadings, I believe that would have been endangerment. And then also say, well, there's not an, you know, we can't, we don't, I don't, I'm not required to appoint a guardian ad litem. To me, that's
I thought the court, at least for part of it, was focusing on the budgetary issues for the court. And, you know, whether that's a valid reason or not. I mean, I think there's some case law that says, I mean, the court did, I think, give the parties an option to, you know, pay for that or jointly, you know, do that. So is there an argument, Ms. Bullock, that since you were given that opportunity and did not take advantage of it, that this argument has been waived?
My recollection, and again, I'd have to look through the briefings, but we not only requested the appointment of a guardian ad litem, we requested if the court, you know, lacked budgetary, the way lacked the budget to do this type of situation, that there should be a private evaluator or a professional appointed. So we argued it both ways to my recollection, and I believe that's in my brief. So,
did the court specifically reject then the private evaluator? And say, no, I'm not going to, or I guess it was a she, you know, she said, I'm not going to do that either.
I believe so. I do believe okay. That's referenced in her order too. So to my recollection, she flat out denied either the appointment of a guardian or the appointment of a third party professional. And in this case, Your Honor, it's exceedingly interesting because then this would have offered the child, who's then was, I believe, 12 years old, to state his own preference. Both parents and the child's therapist all agreed that it was appropriate for him to be have his opinion heard, for lack of a better way to present it.
That may be so, but as I read the district court's order, the district court was concerned about the child stating a preference or participating in the proceeding for reasons that the court would be aware of and the court might be concerned about, where the parties might not and therapists might not. And I'm speaking specifically of the district court's concern that that your client, at least from the district court's perspective, was both lacking in credibility and had a tendency to, I'll use my own words here, sort of manipulate the process. And the court was concerned for the child that if the court invited the child to provide a position, that mom, given the court's concerns and history of the district court with mom, that mom would then have the incentive to pressure the child, manipulate the child, and engage in with the child in a way that would be harmful to the child. Correct me if you think I've misstated the district court's concerns, and indicate if you can why, if that is correct, why that would be an abuse of the district court's discretion.
I believe this case presents a unique set of facts where the parties couldn't agree to anything, but they both agreed that the child's preference should be taken into consideration. That was an agreement. So if Mr. Peterson had issue with that, then he should have said that.
Right, but I'm focusing not on Mr. But my point is the district court had a perspective that would differ from both moms and dads. So the district court had a perspective based upon the court's interaction with mom and the court's perspective of mom in relationship to the son. So I'm trying to get a sense of, do you think I'm correct about whether that's the district court's stated concerns? And if I am correct, indicate why that would be an abuse of discretion for the court to say, regardless of mom and dad's beliefs about the child's ability to state a preference, the court is going to intervene in the interest of the child.
Well, Your Honor, I would say a few things to that. I would say, yes, that was documented. The court was concerned about that. So yes, you're accurate in your interpretation of that. I would also point to the fact that my client could not enter in as one of the exhibits, the respondent's psychological eval, which was from a court-appointed evaluator that said he I'm paraphrasing here, but he presents an overtly optimistic and positive light, and he never received the therapy that he was supposed to reduce the party's conflict, because he was not, even though he appeared to be overly positive about things, he was not understanding his participation in the conflict. So that, I would say, yeah, that's a problem, right, for the court to just ignore this, that the court wouldn't permit us to submit evidence that shows that maybe what Dad is reporting to the court is overly optimistic and not accurate. He didn't get the therapy to address this conflict, which the conflict was the primary reason the court pulled custody, essentially. The other issue was that in this case, again, I don't want to rehash it, but to keep it brief, everybody agreed, including the child's psychologist, that it was appropriate for him to state his opinion. So to just disregard that and interject the court's own concerns about that, when everyone else, parents, psychologist or therapist, I don't know if she's a psychologist, but is saying, no, this child can testify or participate. We also, again, offered if it wasn't an interview by the court, that a third party professional would have participated in this, or guardian ad litem, all perfectly fine. But the court, in my opinion, was reluctant to let any evidence come in that was not favorable to Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Ms. Bullock. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. And then counsel for respondent. You have to unmute there, Ms. Prince. Thank you.
There we go. Cheryl Prince for Chael Peterson. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. As this court has stated in Amaria, interference with a parent-child relationship means any constellation of behaviors that could evoke a disturbance in the relationship between a child and the parent, including cutting off access, denying information about activities, medical decisions, denying contact, and a sustained source of such conduct may be grounds for modifying custody. This case goes far beyond Amaria and is a poster child for the very basis of such a modification. In this case, the parties had been in front of this court and this judge, I think by the judge's own count, four times before making a motion for the modification. And the court was presented with a myriad of information as part of that motion that fully justified the court's decision to hear and to grant the modification of custody. The arguments that the appellant raises are simply red herrings to detract this court from her conduct and the effect of her conduct on the child. In this case, Chael provided three or four notebooks filled with emails and records documenting the actions of the appellant. This isn't just his word against hers. These are multiple documents where she instructs medical providers not to communicate with him, where she cancels appointments, where she refuses to cooperate with court-ordered psychological counseling, which she indicates she's not going to participate in the child's conferences or the individualized education program that was developed to help him with his school issues.
Prince, I mean, I think we're all aware of right. Or speaking for myself only, I certainly got a pretty good idea of what the district court thought of Ms. Bullock's client. But, you know, if this was going to be a change because of physical endangerment or neglect, wasn't the court required to appoint a guardian ad litem?
I don't believe this was a change. I don't believe the court was required to appoint a guardian ad litem for
why not
endangerment or neglect. We weren't alleging that she was neglecting the behaviors. I don't believe it wasn't rising to physical neglect or physical abuse, rather that it was a concerted course of conduct that rose to the level of endangerment. The court is not required under the statute to appoint a guardian ad litem in every case where endangerment is alleged. This is it's only required, it's a mandatory appointment if it's domestic abuse or neglect. Otherwise, it's within the court's discretion and it's permissive.
Well, in this case, the court's discretion here. So the court believes that it would be through the dovetail with the guardian ad litem issue and the child stating a preference. So the court says, no, we're not going to let the child state a preference because of two reasons, as I read the district court's opinion or order. One was the district court simply had a bright line general rule, children of this age, nope, not going to consider their preference. And then a case-specific reason, mom's manipulative behavior from the court's perspective and the concern about pressure on the child and the harm that might pose the child. Wouldn't a guardian, well, first of all, should we be concerned about the generalized statement by the district court that seemed to suggest that no child of this child's age would ever be allowed to speak and offer preference rather than focusing on the court, rather this particular child? And secondly, related to that, wouldn't appointing a guardian ad litem have provided a buffer that would have allayed the court's concerns about mom manipulating the child if a guardian ad litem could have an engagement with the child and then represent the child's preference on behalf of the child?
Under the totality of the circumstances, I don't believe a guardian ad litem would have added anything to this record that was not already present. This court heard from everybody a guardian ad litem would have talked to. The court heard from mom, dad, teachers, school administration, friends and family of the individuals. The court, as finder of fact, heard from the same individuals a guardian ad litem would have heard from. And I don't want the guardian ad litem's judgment to be substituted for the court's finding of fact authority. With regard to the child's preference, I don't believe there was any dispute by either one of these parents that if asked by anybody, if the child was willing to express a preference, would have simply said, I want it to be fair, meaning that he just wanted it equal time. Basically, he wanted his parents to stop fighting about it. The psychological, the diagnostic assessment that was completed just prior to trial indicated that he's an internalizing young child who lacks assertiveness and wants to please others so much that he will not necessarily offer anything other than what people want to hear. I mean, that's paraphrasing, but the diagnostic assessment suggests that he might not cooperate because he had been so counseled against counseling by the appellant, but B, even if he did present information, it wouldn't have been insightful. Moreover, a 12-year-old's opinion under the circumstances that we're dealing with here, he's not old enough or mature enough to understand the implications of his parents' behaviors on what is in his best interests. The Wolfridge field trip was the seminal event that this court focused on that demonstrated the appellant was unable to understand how her actions were adversely affecting this child.
Well, that was obviously very significant with the district court, and obviously from just a human perspective and from looking at the testimony of the principal and the concerns that this was sort of odd behavior and the child didn't get to participate, that all seemed to be very significant. But what do you make of the timing? I mean, by the time the trial occurs, the hearing occurs, this was it about a year and a half earlier that the Wolf?
Maybe a year.
So,
year and a half.
Is that something that hangs over mom's head perpetually if she made what appears to be a very bad mistake and putting her concerns over the child's at some point? I mean, given the acrimony that may go with divorce, those things may tend to wane over time. What do you make of the district court focusing on that issue in light of the timing of it?
If that were the only issue, I can certainly understand the court's comments. I still think it is a significant issue because it deprived the child of a big piece of that child's educational experience. But it wasn't the only issue. She forged Chell's name on the child's passport. She took the child to Cuba without telling him. She would cancel medical appointments.
What was the most recent significant event that occurred in this regard?
I don't mean to cut you off. Sorry. Right before trial, Chell, who had sole legal custody under the temporary order at that time, took the child into, I believe it was a well child checkup. The doctor suggested that there be a urology consult. And Chell made an appointment, notified the appellant of that appointment. The appellant, despite the fact of not having the authority to do so, canceled the appointment and began a series of interferences with having the child seen by a medical professional. We then had to bring that issue in front of the district court to get resolution. This is a very embarrassing issue to anybody, much less a 12 or 13-year-old child. And the fact that right before we were on the eve of going into trial, she ignores the court's dictates regarding authority and does this anyway is the most recent example.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and this was at a time after the district court had temporarily given father the authority to make those decisions.
Correct. Yes, it was. And again, it's the Wolfridge incident was a significant incident, but it was also one of many incidents over time. And this is a judge who had been with this family for many years. And I believe that was one of the reasons the court invited the respondent to make the oral motion. And the oral motion was granted. Both parties were given a full opportunity to be heard on the motion to change parenting time. The appellant submitted two briefs, I believe, subsequent to the hearing. The respondent submitted an affidavit, which, although similar, was distinctly different in format and structure and emphasis. And it was fully briefed. The appellant was not denied her ability to contest the motion, and the district court properly heard and granted that motion.
Should we be concerned about the allegations made in the during the appeal that father essentially changed positions, changed testimony, changed perspective about the amount of parenting time and whether custody should be an issue after being prompted by the district court as opposed to on his own?
I don't think the court should be concerned about that. In any family situation, especially one as stressful and as ongoing as this one, Chell is living in essentially a bubble, trying to do the best he can. And as anybody who's experienced stress, you are not necessarily always able to look as an outsider in and see what a logical course of conduct is. My living is made by being able to be an outsider, helping people guide through things. So you're doing the best you can under a very stressful situation. You made the decision to move forward with one type of motion, but in bringing it to the court, the district court, as this court has pointed out, has an obligation to act in the best interest of the child. The district court, seeing the totality of the allegations raised in the affidavit, did point out the fact that this was something different and was more severe than he might have thought it was. The court invited him. The court did not require that he reconsider it. The court invited him to take another look at it. He took another look at the situation and amended his motion verbally at the hearing. And from that point forward, it was a motion for modification of custody, to which the appellant responded regularly, repeatedly, and proceeded to trial on. So it's a situation of not necessarily being able to see the forest for the trees, but when you have someone who is in a neutral position, giving a more objective insight, understanding the direction that it should head.
Prince, I wanted to follow up on a point Ms. Bullock raised in response to a question I had about the guardian ad litem. At one point in rejecting the request for a guardian ad litem by Ms. Bullock's client, the court was referring to budgetary issues. And then there's some suggestion on the record, well, you know, if you want to get your sort of private evaluator and pay for it, you can do that. And then I asked Ms. Bullock, you know, did the court then veto that as well? I couldn't, perhaps I can't just find anything about in the order about that. But did the court also, after offering sort of the, let the parties sort of pick up the tab, get their own evaluator, what happened? I mean, did the court either then say, well, I'm not going to let you do that either, or did that just not happen, that parties just chose not to do that? I'm trying to get a feel for that.
Forgive me if I am misrepresenting the record. I did take a look through all of the things in the days leading up to this argument. As I recall it, and again, it's not intentional if I'm misrepresenting, as I recall it, there was a request for a guardian ad litem. The court did discuss the fact that in our district, we don't have the resources for anything other than mandatory appointments. Then the appellant requested the opportunity for a private appointment. My recollection is that we opposed that appointment even as a private appointment and opposed paying for it because we did not believe a guardian ad litem was necessary. The child was in therapy at that time. And again, we did not believe, respondent did not believe, and still does not believe that a guardian would have added anything to this situation that was not already present. The child had a counselor who could testify as to the information. Oh, I'm sorry. And we had a guardian ad litem would not have added anything. We didn't think it was necessary, a necessary expense, and disruptive to the child. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. If you've wrapped up, you could take a minute if you wanted to, but you're good at that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Prince. And Ms. Bullock, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
She's muted.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. I would just keep it brief. I understand that this is a complex case. I'm not making light of that. And I understand that the judge's decisions and job and authorities are, they have to operate in the best interest of the children. But I'm just going to point out that it is not logical. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but it's not logical that there's enough endangerment to pull custody, and in my opinion, via a sua sponte effort by the court, but also not sufficient to require a mandatory appointment.
Well, you say mandatory appointment. Are you alleging that the district court based its decision on neglect or abuse? And if not, what do you see in the guardian ad litem statute that would mandate the appointment of a guardian ad litem in this case?
Well, to pull custody, there has to be an endangerment standard, so to speak. For appointment of a guardian ad litem, it does say that the court has to have reason to believe that the minor child is a victim of domestic child abuse or neglect. The record is replete.
Well, just to be clear, are you suggesting that endangerment is synonymous with abuse or neglect?
Essentially, yes. I think if there's that level. Can't there be
I mean, the district court in this case, as I understood it, based its decision on the most significantly the psychological harm that was caused, the district court believed was caused by mom's interaction, sort of bringing the child into the dispute and making unilateral decisions when she didn't have the authority to do so, that were harmful to the child. I can see how that might be endangerment. I don't see how that can be abuse or neglect under the definition of the terms in the guardian ad litem statute. So help me to understand why you believe that endangerment and neglect or endangerment and abuse are synonymous.
Well, the court, in my opinion, focused heavily on the parties' conflict and inability to get along as to show that there was an endangering effect on the child. So I think we're talking nuances here.
Well, I'm talking about not what the court decided, but the law. What is it? What have you found in the case law or what words in the statute would help us to agree with you that endangerment is the same thing as abuse and neglect so as to mandate the appointment of a guardian?
That's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor. I think that there's cases cited in my brief, the Nice-Peterson standard, to take away custody from a parent. And also, I think this dovetails into another point that I wanted to make. The court-appointed psychologists, I believe, that evaluated Mr. Peterson, we couldn't get that his testimony nor his report in its Exhibit 109A as part of this trial. That the actual psychologist in his report that was not admitted indicated that Dad didn't really understand, I'm paraphrasing here, but Dad didn't really understand the part that he plays in the conflict. The court sort of ignored that it takes two to tango, so to speak. And for example, I'll just note one point in the court's order. She states that, you know, that this child had to have two parent conferences because the parents couldn't get along. And that when the child was in fourth grade, Mr. Peterson just decided he wanted to attend both conferences, which was within his right to do. I understand that it is his right. I'm not making light of that, but I also understand that that contributes to this co-parenting conflict.
Why?
Well,
why? I mean, if you're, the district court, I think, was focused on the fact that, okay, so Dad wants to be at both, Mom wants to be at both, Mom chooses not to attend because Dad's going to be around, and she won't even attend by phone. And this is where it struck me, and I imagine it appears to have struck the district court, the degree of acrimony. That mom would tell the teacher, I can't even stand the sound of his voice. Therefore, she's not going to participate even by phone in the child's parent-teacher conference. So I don't know, maybe we're getting off too much into the weeds here. I don't want to take you off the point you're trying to make, but that seemed to be the concern of the district court, that it was mom's frustration with Dad or inability to get along with Dad that in fact is at the heart of the case. You can't have joint legal custody when you have that level of disagreement that prevents mom or both parents from participating together. And I know it was a long question. I hope Judge Smith will give you plenty of time to respond if I've eaten up your time.
That is okay, Your Honor. As I said, justice is patient. I would say, this is what I would say to that. I would say, yes, I agree in the fact that both parties should attend conferences. In this case, in this very finite set of circumstances, the father in this case didn't follow the therapist, the court-appointed psychologist recommendations that, hey, sir, you may not understand, you may lack some insight into the way that you create problems. Hey, you should go to therapy. He never went to therapy and took it upon himself to just start showing up, even though the school could have two conferences, start showing up at the conference. It's his right to, I understand it's his right, but it's also probably going to create conflict, which I, again, couldn't get that exhibit in, nor could I call the court-appointed psychologist to testify to that. So all in all, Your Honor, just to sum it up.
On that point, I do have one question, Judge Smith, if you'll allow me. Were you allowed, I assume your client testified?
Yes.
Did she say he never went to therapy?
I believe the transcript reflects that Mr. Peterson
okay. So,
acknowledged that.
You know, I get it. The I guess my point is I agree the exhibit didn't come in, but you know, you kind of made the point you wanted to make was he didn't go to therapy. So I guess I would say that's harmless error, speaking for myself and not my colleagues.
I have nothing further, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Safely. Okay, thank you. Thank you.